Welcome to another episode of Perspectives, the Behavioral Health Business Podcast. I'm Morgan Gonzalez, reporter for BHB, and I'll be your host for this episode. In this conversation, I'm chatting with Jason Youngblood, Senior Director of Behavioral Account Management and Sales Operation at Cigna, and Christian Ranta, CEO and founder of Maru Health. Jason, Christian, and I discussed how payers and providers define quality care, what Cigna looks for in a behavioral health partner, and tips for providers when forging reimbursement agreements with health plans. With all that said, let's jump in. Hi, Christian and Jason. I'm just thrilled you both can be here. Before we get going into the meat of this discussion, would you both like to introduce yourselves a bit further?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I'm thrilled to be here with you today. My name is Jason Youngblood. I'm a licensed professional counselor by training. I have a sub-clinical specialty in addictions counseling, but I've been with Cigna Healthcare for 22 years, starting out entry-level clinical positions. I now lead behavioral clinical account management for Cigna Healthcare nationally. And essentially, that's a team of clinicians. We don't see individuals. We see organizations. We see companies, big and small. And just like clinicians who see individuals, we work with them as individual companies on their goals and improving the health and well-being by focusing on behavioral of their employee populations. So very fascinating and interesting role.
Perfect. Thank you, Christian.
Hey, I'm Christian. I'm the CEO and one of the founders at Maru Health. And yeah, thanks for having us today. Thanks for having me today. And Maru Health, we are a holistic tech-enabled mental health provider. So we operate nationally, collaborate with Cigna. Big pleasure working with them. And then we basically, our specialties that we help people with depression, anxiety, burnout, PTSD, ADHD, some bipolar as well. But our approach to care is very tech-enabled, but also very holistic. So we also blend in diet, sleep, exercise. We have a biofeedback wearable. So it's not just about CBT or talk therapy. We do that as well, but it's a kind of a more holistic approach. And because of that, we've done extensive research to show that it actually improves outcomes, improves quality of care. And we've published more than 10 studies with Stanford, Harvard, UCSF, and others showing that this approach is also very effective and can help a lot of people. So yeah, thanks for again for having me.
Fantastic. And to start, I want to talk about the biggest issues in behavioral health. The topic I hear come up maybe the most when I ask that question is access to care. I want to ask, is access the most pressing issue right now? And if not, what other issues maybe are top of mind right now and why? Jason, would you like to start?
Yeah, absolutely. I think you really have your finger on the pulse. As I meet with employer groups from the nation's biggest employers down to even the smallest, you know, when I'm meeting with them, the number one thing I hear them talk about is access to care for their employees. You know, we came from a time before COVID when there was a lot more stigma around behavioral health and people weren't talking about it. Over COVID, I think the behavioral health needs just became more evident. But we've also seen behavioral trend at my company in the high teens to low 20s since COVID. So more people than ever are accessing behavioral health care at a time when we have providers burning out, providers leaving, and less people entering the space. So it has become very difficult for people to get appointments, very long wait time. So that is the number one issue. I will say, in addition to access to care, other things that people are concerned about are the explosion of available options to take care of your mental health and well-being and navigating which solutions may be best. So there's some confusion because it's great. There's so many different ways to take care of yourself, but who needs what and when? And the other thing is, how do we assure that people are getting into high quality care?
It's funny you mentioned that. I was just talking with someone earlier today about that confusion from number of options. So it's really interesting to me that we're balancing simultaneously an issue of access and almost this, like, not necessarily overabundance, but yeah, this confusion. So we're dealing with both of those at the same time.
Yeah, for sure.
Christian, what about you? What's top of mind for you as issues in behavioral health?
Yeah, I mean, like, access for sure. Like, that's also what we're seeing. It's been a huge problem you know, since the beginning, pretty much like when we founded the company in 2016 and started building. And I think, like, of course, like the COVID time, you know, further exaggerated the needs, and like the explosion was, or, you know, it was a big explosion that happened then. But I think there's another thing that I'm seeing, like, more and more in the maybe last year, there's been more and more talk about the quality of care. Like, how do we make sure that, like, access to what? Like, access is great, but then, like, how do you make sure that access is to something that's actually effective and good? Because there's also, like, you know, there was a Time magazine article in 2023 looking at the quality of therapy in America. And unfortunately, like, there's actually a decline in quality of care in the last 10 years. So we've added a lot of access, but then again, like, the quality is not controlled to a large extent. And I think that's another thing that I think, it, you know, in tandem with looking at access and how do we make sure that people do get access, how do we then also make sure that the care that's being provided is really, like, effective? And I think that comes down to the fact that behavioral health historically hasn't really been, like, that data-driven, or hasn't been measurement-based care. And you know, for good reasons, like, it's been hard to measure these things, and it's been just kind of, you know, not so easily available to collect data. You know, today with all the digital devices and everything else, it's become much more easier. So there's obvious reasons for that. But I think the industry is, like, moving in that direction, at least what I'm seeing is that there's access to care, definitely huge challenge, huge point of interest at the moment. But then more and more seeing things kind of, you know, escalate around the quality of care.
And Jason, I'll ask you this question too, but Christian, how do you actually define, I know you mentioned measurement, but how do you actually define quality care?
Well, I mean, like, when we started the company and we came into this space, we realized that there's standard measures that are being used, like self-reported measures that are being used, like, you know, pretty much across the country, at least in some regard, but doesn't mean that they're systematically used for each patient and every patient that goes through care, no matter the provider. So that was not the case, but there were definitely, like, scales like the PHQ and the GAD that are, you know, that are gold standard. They've been studied and researched, and they've been used across the industry for the last, I don't know, 20 years, something like that. But then what I think what the real challenge is that, like, how do we make sure that all the care that's being provided really is measurement-based care? And I mean, that's going to be a transition. It's not realistic to expect that every therapist is going to adopt those scales and start doing that. It's not going to happen easily. But then again, like, how do we still, and, you know, many people would also argue that, like, well, hey, using self-reports, it's not adequate. Like, you know, people answer whatever. And, you know, that's to an extent, that's true, but it's still, I think it's still better to measure things versus not measure things. And then kind of keep on developing the measures and the ways to quantify things. So I have, like, this kind of an old engineering kind of way of thinking, is just that, like, what you can't measure, you can't manage. So I think it's generally, like, really important to just measure things, even if the measures are not perfect, and then keep on collecting data and trying to understand and learn, like, what works and what doesn't work.
And I'm curious if, you know, in this sort of small sample size we have, if providers and payers see quality differently. So Jason, how do you define quality?
Yeah, at a company like Cigna Healthcare, our behavioral provider network is very broad in that we have both outpatient professionals who make up a significant portion. Some of them are parts of clinics or facilities, but then we also have providers that provide acute care services. So mental health inpatient, substance use disorder treatment, detox, residential. So it is very broad. I've been in the industry now for over 20 years. And I think it was easier 20 years ago to measure the effectiveness and quality of the acute care facilities, because you looked at, you know, average lengths of stay as compared to, like, evidence-based care and, you know, how people should be recovering from their disease on average. But then other really important factors, like, do they have aftercare plan? Do they go to an aftercare appointment? That's the most critical piece of being in acute care, is having follow-up care. So having an appointment within 7 days or 30 days, and then readmission. It's a little bit more tricky from an outpatient professional counseling perspective. But I think the way that we're looking at it and the way we're defining quality of care is really focusing on time to care. How available are providers? How responsive are they? That is really important, because we need to make sure that people get access to outpatient care when they need it. Also, therapeutic alliance is really important. Are they staying in treatment with the same provider Research shows that if you have 3 visits with an outpatient professional counselor, you tend to have better health and well-being and lower medical costs. So everybody, like, call your therapist and schedule your 3 visits for the year. You tend to do better when you have that. But we're also looking at avoidance of higher levels of care. So stabilization. And we know that some people will be evaluated and need higher levels of care. So thinking about those things as far as measurements of care, or quality of care. But then, as Christian mentioned, you know, the PHQ-9 and the GAD-7, other indexes and tools to really quantify changes. So we are aligned from that perspective.
But it's like good point, Jason. Maybe like if I may continue a little bit, like I think it's a really good point that you make there, that like it's also like this is like really a complicated system, and it's like really complex. It's a complex challenge to measure things effectively. And I think, like, you know, what I really like also is that there's, like you said, there's also other ways to measure, like, you know, the continuity of care, like the alliance, but also like there's also, you know, more and more possibilities to look at the cost of care and the claim savings. You know, I think Cigna and Cigna Evernorth did like a big study fairly recently on looking at, was it like 300,000 patients worth of claims, and looking at the outcomes of like how many visits, you know, helped save money. And I think that, you know, the outcomes were very, so like, very, you know, convincing. And I think, like, also looking at the cost side of things, or looking at the, you know, readmission or ED visits, things like these are also great indicators of quality of behavioral health.
Right. Jason, how easy or difficult is it for Cigna to find high quality behavioral health care partners?
Yeah, I think there's been some stigma around outpatient professional clinicians who participate in insurance company networks. I've dealt with that stigma throughout my career. However, we've seen our network has doubled in size over our behavioral health network of outpatient professional counselors, doubled in size. I think we'll hit the 500,000 mark by the end of the year. The attrition rate on our network is very low, people voluntarily leaving, and the net promoter score of our network providers from our customers is very high. And so we've got really dedicated clinicians across the country providing really good services. I will say, you know, having been in this field for over 20 years, my first mentor and my first job taught me that providing therapy was more art than science. And I've seen a shift. I didn't quite buy that back then, but I've seen a shift, but I would never disagree with her. I love her. But I have seen a shift that we are focusing more on the science and to complement the art, right? And so I think there has been nice evolution in the industry and in the field as more clinicians are part of groups or clinics where there's practice management systems that can have easy measurement around some metrics. And there's a focus because people want to do good work and make a difference, and measuring it can be difficult. And so it has gotten much easier. So I would say no problems in recruiting providers, and we're getting better every year at defining what high quality is and how to measure that and how to communicate with our providers, because they're interested. They want to know what the quality metrics look like.
So shout out to Jason's mentor for being accurate back in the day. Christian, were you about to say something?
Yeah, I just wanted to comment. I mean, like, that's a fascinating point that you made, Jason, about the fact that, like, it is definitely like kind of a mix of art and science and like therapy and psychology in general. But I think what we found at Merrill Health, and what's kind of part of our philosophy, is that, like, the human connection, like being seen, being heard, like, is really, really important. And the psychological side of mental health is very much connected to you know, the other human, the connection and understanding and processing things. But then why we've kind of built more of a holistic model, where we also go into like diet, exercise, sleep, is that the more and more we understand mental health society, and more research is coming out, we're also seeing and understanding that actually mental health is very much physical health, and that there's huge importance in the kind of connection. Like, if you're not sleeping, you can't get better from clinical depression. Like, it's clinical depression is not just a psychological issue, but it also has a very strong physiological. And, you know, sometimes more than in other cases, it depends case by case. And then things like inflammation, like your diet, like exercise can be very effective, even as a sole intervention for mental illnesses. So kind of our understanding of society is, like, I guess, further broadening and the mind and body, they're coming together more, which I think is great. And it will, in the future, allow us to better track also efficacy and outcomes and kind of, you know, with balancing the art and science.
Christian, I think you're talking about one of the ways that, you know, you can deliver high quality care, but what are some of the challenges to delivering high quality behavioral health care?
Yeah, I guess there's systemic challenges in a sense that, like, if you think about it, most providers out there have not been doing like measurement based care. And I think it's someone told me, I'm not sure if this is true anymore, but someone told me from a large national health plan that like 95% of the providers are not doing measurement based care. It's, you know, it's kind of changing, but it's still like a majority of the providers are not doing that. So I think just like kind of that's a systemic shift that needs to happen one way or another, and it's going to take some time. So I think that's one big challenge. And then again, I think the other thing would be like how to incentivize measurement based care if we, you know, all accept and believe that it's going to yield better quality in the future, which I think has been shown, you know, in many research studies to be the case. But then, like, can we build in incentives to reward providers that are actually providing, you know, or practicing measurement-based care? And then, like, what are some of these ways? I think incentives are really powerful. And I think there's more and more these discussions happening, like, kind of, you know, if as a provider, like one of our smaller, so like regional health plan partners, they just started paying us, like, you know, some pretty significant extra fees every year, just because of the fact that we, with every single patient, we provide measurement-based care and we do measure everything that's going on with every single patient. So I think it's kind of like just that mind shift and infrastructure shift. But I think where, you know, people like Jason have a lot of, you know, power in this change and shift is to kind of incentivize the high-quality care. And again, not saying that like therapy, there's like various needs and there's various flavors and colors here. But as a general movement, I think it makes sense to start like really trying to move towards more measurement-based care.
Jason, anything you want to hop in on that Christian brought up there?
You know, Christian was really, you know, hitting the part as a clinician that I'm passionate about around whole person health and how this is coming together. You know, as a young clinician, treating addictions and mental health issues, like I recognize that sleep and exercise, hydration and nutrition, and even you know, social, like the level of social support that people had, were really big factors in how well people progressed on their treatment plan. So much so that I got my personal training certification, not to train folks, but just so that I could help them link their mind body. So I really love what you said there. And I really hope to see this continued evolution of that mind body connection and as we move forward. So two thumbs up.
That's so cool. So you can give us some fitness tips after yes. The call. Okay. And Jason, you said that it's not necessarily difficult for Cigna to find high quality behavioral health partners. What are you looking for when you are looking to create those relationships? And are there any red flags that would cause you to avoid working with a certain provider?
So I would think that, you know, as we're looking to recruit providers, of course, they need to have an independent license in their state, and their license needs to be in good standing. So that is like foundational baseline. We serve commercial employers. And so when we're selling or when we bring on a new employer as a partner, really looking to see where their membership lives is to see like how we need to grow and evolve our network. We really love to look at from a commercial employer, especially with new clients, who are their people seeing from the behavioral perspective who may not be in our network? And let's bring those folks in so that there can be a great continuity of care. It's really important, though, for the providers who are in our network to be responsive. And so respond when our membership reaches out or when we're reaching out to find care and support for somebody. And we do regular checks. And so if they're not, when we check, if they're not responding to us, we do suppress them from our searches. So I think that, you know, we're looking for clinicians in good standing located near our membership. Those are really important factors. And then we look at pockets of clinicians who are practicing in evidence-based care, really to think about how to innovate. For Christian's prior comments around how do we innovate, really looking for those who are practicing evidence-based care to think about how do we evolve even further.
Perfect. And since I have both of you here together, which is very exciting for me, let's talk about reimbursement. I would love to hear from both of you tips from your experience on how providers and payers can work together to align goals and forge agreements. Christian, could you take a stab at that first?
Sure, yeah. Well, we are definitely grateful working with Cigna on being like flexible, getting us started together. Yeah, already a few years ago. So what I mean by that is that like we are a very sort of like different kind of way of providing mental health care. We, as I mentioned, we combine the mind and the body very strongly, but we also have like a biofeedback wearable for the members, a wellness device. And then we also, we're more like a programmatic offering. So kind of a therapy which has a beginning and an end for most of our patients. So people can really like dive in and get the benefits in a limited time frame versus like being in a quote unquote endless therapy. And this model isn't the typical model. So us contracting with a payer, getting reimbursed and figuring all that stuff out is by no means trivial. And actually like we are, again, very grateful that we were able to already years ago find a way to get contracted with Cigna with this kind of a novel model. So yeah, just like that's generally for us being a challenge working with payers in the market, that it's just not easy to fit into the existing standard fee for service structures with all of these variety of services that we've bundled together. So that's kind of one perspective from us, from our viewpoint.
Yeah,
I'll pick up from there. I'm going to acknowledge two things that, number one, talking about money can be very uncomfortable for everyone, whether you're an outpatient individual who has your own company or your own practice, or whether you're part of a clinic or a group or an organization like Christian. And so it can be a little uncomfortable. The second thing I want to acknowledge is what Christian said. When you're in a well-established system that is really big, it is really difficult to think about how to do things differently. And sometimes it takes, I think at baseline, a passionate commitment to doing what's best for others and building on that, like that connection. And I think at Cigna Healthcare and Maru, like we've come together and we've had many discussions and we get really excited in some ways and then have to step back a little bit and then get excited in other ways. But just to keep that conversation going. And so if there are others who are following, understand it's not easy on either side, but you have to really kind of meet each other at your commitment to improving the health and well-being and just improving the behavioral health of those that we serve.
And talking about alternative payment models, and often we, at least at BHB, often talk about moving away from a fee-for-service system or the future of the reimbursement system. What reimbursement trends do y'all have your eyes on? And I'll just let whoever wants to jump on that first go ahead.
Yeah, well, maybe I can chime in. I mean, one thing that we've done, we announced this last year that we put 100% of our fees at risk against performance guarantees, outcomes, access time, and patient engagement. And this is something which we've been offering now for, like a year roughly in the market. And actually, what we've learned is that for most payers, it is actually really difficult to administer something like this. So, and this is something that I kind of intentionally want to like shake the tree a little bit here, because like I guess most people would immediately agree that like us as a provider putting our 100% fees at risk to serve the members, to quick access, great outcomes, great engagement is a positive thing. But still, the systems are so often so like, kind of difficult to adapt to like things like these kinds of structures, that we can't administer or deploy these models. So that's kind of one thing I think generally, like value-based care and like putting fees at risk, performance guarantees, I think these things are very important for the further development of quality of care and building the right incentives in the market. But it also it's quite difficult. I mean, like the historical structures, reimbursement structures, contracting structures do not easily allow things like these.
And Christian, you're saying it's important to turn to these alternative systems. When do you think, are we already seeing a lot of traction there? And, or, you know, when do you expect to see increased traction? Do you have like a timeline in your brain?
Well, we have like several value-based contracts in behavioral health, in mental health. So, you know, it's definitely happening, but it's not the norm. Mm-hmm. And we are very much like wanting to do and wanting to put our like money where our mouth is. But it doesn't, it's not always that easy. Like we've just learned that, you know, it's, there's like some structural barriers quite often, but yeah, we do have like value-based contracts, several of them, and we are eager to kind of do more.
And what about sort of the timeline for trends in the industry at large? Cause you said, you know, there's not that many of the providers with these contracts. So do you have a number of years that you think we might see any major shifts in reimbursement systems?
I mean, like maybe Jason, I think you may have a better perspective on like, since you see a lot more on your side on this, like working with different providers, that like, what do you think, like what's maybe, maybe like a, how do you see the bigger trend?
I would say it's, as we were talking about that, you know, when I had kids, somebody was like, the days go by very slowly, but the years go by quickly. And so I think as we're trying to make some of these changes in the industry, like it seems like things are dragging slowly, but time does get away from us. And so fee-for-service is very standard in the industry. I think it will always have its time and place. I think we're seeing some of the shift in kind of the Medicare, the Medicaid space, in the commercial employer business, where most large employers especially are self-funded. We can't just change our reimbursement models without really helping them understand, the employers who are funding the claims, that what we're doing is delivering high quality care and high value. So it is, as Christian said, very complex, but we are moving towards that. So while fee-for-service is foundational, we do believe that, you know, a value-based care arrangements are the wave of the future. You know, in some regards, I think it can't happen fast enough, but I think we will see a continued slow evolution up until we hit a tipping point. And then I think things will go very fast.
Mm. Any other reimbursement trends that you want to highlight, Jason?
You know, I think Christian mentioned some risk sharing. I think in my organization, it's a little bit in its infancy in the behavioral healthcare space, but yeah, I think Christian highlighted. Yeah.
Something to keep an eye on. Okay. I will now ask you both to look into your metaphorical crystal balls. So much is happening in behavioral health. I know we've been talking about some of these sort of moving parts, but what do you expect the behavioral health industry to look like in the next 5 to 10 years? And that's like an incredibly broad question, so you can take that in whatever direction you want. But what do you think some of the major things we'll be seeing in the next decade are?
Yeah, I can start. We know that individuals with behavioral health issues from a total medical spend are 3 to 6 times more costly. And Milman data suggests that. Our own book of business shows that. And so what I would love to see is that we get much better at drawing the line between the impact of behavioral health on whole person health and overall costs, and the impact of timely, high quality, effective treatment on not only improvement in whole person health, but on lowering overall medical cost and trend. So what I would love to see in 5 years, when I'm going out and talking to employers, I'm talking about whole person health and overall spend, and being asked a little bit less to laser in on behavioral, although behavioral is a key driver to whole person health. So I would love to be called upon in 5 years to talk about whole person health and how behavioral drives that.
Perfect. Sweet. Well, we should talk about that. I think we're talking about that now, but yeah, we'll keep talking about that and exciting stuff. Christian, what about you? What do you think we'll see in the next 10 years?
Yeah, well, I love what Jason's saying, and I'm definitely like in the same boat there. Like that's our philosophy as a provider, as a company, like whole person health and building that. But I think what I'm also seeing is that like AI in decision support, in clinical, like supercharging clinical workflows, things like these, is definitely becoming bigger and bigger. And it's going to like take a lot of kind of a quote unquote waste out of the system in the future, which is brilliant. I'm sure most providers are already excited about like not needing to do so many, like not needing to write so much and like, you know, transcribe whatever else. So I think these things are really adding value fast. So I think that's exciting. It's going to transform the industry in some, you know, in many ways. I also think that the like the payment models and like just really like looking at like how do we understand value that we're creating for the patients and for the payers, and how do we measure that value effectively, and how do we create structures and incentives in understanding that value creation and measuring it and incentivizing the right kinds of activities. It's like, I mean, in physical health, there's numerous different structures where you really reward like centers of excellences that are delivering better outcomes than like standard practice, whatever else. So there's like a kind of, it's kind of more nuanced in many ways in on the physical health side. Again, for obvious reasons. But I think behavioral health is moving in that direction. And I believe that in the next 5 to 10 years, we're going to see a lot of movement in that direction. And then one thing that I've been saying, people often ask me this question. I honestly think that behavioral health is going to become as big as physical health. I think mental health is like, it's as important, if not more important than physical health eventually. And that like finding that like balance is going to be important. And I think we're still like, I don't know, behavioral health is probably still like between 5 to 10% of the spending of physical health. So it's still very small. I think it's grown a lot. It used to be like 3 to 5%, but it's, you know, it's, there's still ways to go.
Perfect. And Christian, I'll stick with you, and this can align with your last answer, but if there's one thing that you hope to see change in the behavioral health industry in the next decade, what's that?
Wow, one thing. That's a tough one. I think I'll just say that like if we do more data-driven care, more measurement-based care, I think that's, if I had to choose one thing, I think that's going to bring so much positive evolution in the space as a systemic change. So I would go for that.
Okay. Jason, what has your vote?
I would say, you know, given the fact that 1 out of 4 of us has a behavioral health condition, and the sad, sad statistic that 55% of us with behavioral health conditions, myself included, anxiety since as long as I can remember, 55% of us will never get access to care in our lifetime for that condition. And the research shows, especially once you have a chronic medical condition and a comorbid behavioral health condition that's not treated, not only is the quality of your life much more poor, but the longevity of your life decreases dramatically by up to 25 years. And so if I had one wish, what I would love to see is that we take that number 55%, which I think is a big failing grade, and we get that down to 0. Like, everybody who has a need should be able to get care or support for that need.
Fantastic. Okay. Thank you both so much. I really enjoyed this conversation. Before I wrap things up, any final thoughts? Any, if there's one thing you want listeners to take away from this conversation, what it'd be?
Thanks for spending the time. Thanks for listening. And yeah, this is takes a village to move the mountains here. So all the collaboration is appreciated.
Yeah, I echo that. I will say, you know, a lot of the things we talked about are very complex and can seem overwhelming. But as I advise business leaders across the country, there's one thing that we all can do that's very simple, is that we can take really good care of ourselves, our own health and well-being, our own behavioral health and well-being, and be an example to others at work and at home. If you want to improve the future, then start with yourself.
What a note to end on. Thank you both so very much for being here.
Yeah.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Behavioral Health Business Perspectives Podcast. I'm Morgan Gonzalez with WTWH Media, Chicago, Illinois.